Hi, I'm Dr. Pam Peek, and welcome to episode 267 of Her, the podcast where you're going to hear the naked truth about her mind, her body, her life, and her elders, especially in the era of COVID. Huh. Think about that one for a moment. Yep, it's going to be terrific. And just know that this episode is made possible by our wonderful friends at Smarty Pants Women's Vitamins, the delicious once-a-day gummies. They contain all of the essential vitamins, minerals, and omega oils customized just for women. To learn more, hop on over to SmartyPantsVitamins.com. All right, here's your first official reminder to click on iTunes after this episode to rate and review the show because we love your feedback. Just saying. And I'll give you another official reminder toward the end of the episode. All right, it's time for Her.
Her, the podcast.
The naked truth about women.
Her mind.
Her body.
Her life.
It's all about her.
So, I read the Wall Street Journal avidly. Nowadays, I don't know what to read anymore because I don't even want to know what the news is. But I'm absolutely a loyal reader of the Wall Street Journal. And one of my most favorite people who writes for the Wall Street Journal is Dr. Allison Gopnik. And let me tell you a little bit about her and why we're going to be talking about this whole issue of elders, because this comes off one of her most recent columns for the Wall Street Journal. So Dr. Gopnik is a professor of psychology and affiliate professor of philosophy at my alma mater, I'm a little biased here, University of California at Berkeley, where she has taught since 1988. You look so young in those pictures. Ha! Huh. All right. She received her BA from McGill, her PhD from Oxford University, and wised up and finally got back to Berkeley. Okay, that was a good thing. She is a world leader in cognitive science, particularly the study of children's learning and development. She's authored over 100 journal articles, several books, including the best-selling and critically acclaimed popular books, The Scientist in the Crib. All right, that's beautiful. It's just amazing. And this was written back in 1999. The Philosophical Baby, What Children's Minds Tell Us About Love, Truth, and the Meaning of Life. And one of my all-time favorites, The Gardener and the Carpenter. Oh my gosh, I just love this. And this is what's most important. She has three sons, three grandchildren, and obviously lives in Berkeley with her loving better half. So she writes the Mind and Matter Science column for the Wall Street Journal, which is one of the reasons why it just caught my eye when I saw the header, Why Elders Are Indispensable for All of Us, Especially in This Crazy, Crazy-Ass Time. So, Allison, welcome, welcome to the Her podcast.
Glad to be here.
Oh my gosh. All right. So what got you going with this whole theme of elders? I know that you had recently co-edited a text and all, but what was really percolating in your mind about this?
Well, I mean, I suspect a little bit of becoming a grandmother had an autobiographical influence. But at the same time, one of the things that I've been thinking about for a long time is that there's something that evolutionary biologists call life history. And the idea behind life history is you look at an animal and you say, how does its life unfold? How long a childhood does it have? How many babies does it have? When does it have babies? How long does it live? And it turns out that those features of an animal, things like how long it lives or how long a childhood it has, are really, really important in biology and evolution, much more important than you might think it on the surface. So more important to know something about how an animal's life unfolds than it is to understand maybe even what it's like when it's an adult. And I think, you know, sometimes when you look at psychology, for example, there's a certain tendency to think that the 40-year-old white male psychology professor is the apex of all of cognition and psychology, has the greatest mind that's ever been, and everything else is just kind of working up to him or else falling off from him. And that does doesn't really make much sense from an evolutionary perspective. So one of the things that's really distinctive about us humans in particular is that we have this really weird life history. We have a very, very, very long period of childhood, much longer than any of our closest relatives. And then we have this even weirder thing, which is we have a long period of old age. So we're one of only two animals that we know of, only two mammals we know of, that actually has menopause, that actually has this 20 years after we're no longer fertile. And that's been true. We can show from fossil records that that was true as we turned into Homo sapiens. If you look at chimps, for example, by the time chimps are 50, which is about when they're not fertile anymore, they also die. That's their life expectancy. Whereas if you look at humans, even in forager cultures where there isn't a lot of modern medicine, we live until, if we survive past childhood, you're likely to live into your 60s and 70s. So we have this extra 20 years. And for women, this extra 20 years when we're not reproducing anymore. And that seems sort of puzzling, too. So from an evolutionary perspective, why would you have this long time early on, this long childhood, when you're not as productive in the obvious ways? And then we have this extra 20 years when we're, if we're women, we're not reproducing, and we're also not as productive. Why would that be? Why would we have evolved that way? And the special issue of the philosophical transactions of the Royal Society that I just edited, I kind of love this because the Philosophical Transactions of the Royal Society is actually the oldest academic journal on Earth. And
is it really?
Newton, yeah, it was the journal that Newton published in. It's like
oh my God,
the first edition was back in the day in the 17th century when people were reporting on their science. So I really like the fact that the latest special issue is about babies and old people who are not people who've shown up in the science in the 17th century.
Oh my God.
So the question is why? Why do we have this long period? And the great anthropologist Kristen Hawkes has a paper in the special issue about her idea, which is the grandmother hypothesis, which you may have talked about on the show before. Her idea is that those postmenopausal women were actually the key to enabling that long period of childhood. So when you look at resources, for example, for the first year or so of a baby's life, it depends a lot on its, you know, having a breastfeeding mother. But when you think about toddlers, like 2 and 3 year olds in these forager cultures, what they depend on is they depend on grandmothers. Grandmothers are the ones who are giving them the calories that they need to be able to thrive. So one thing is that the grandmothers, the older people, are actually providing the resources for the children. And then in turn, one of the things that we think is that having that long period of childhood lets you learn all the things that you need to learn. It gives you this long time when you can figure out what your environment is like. You can pick up the traditions of your culture. You can learn things without actually having to do things. Now, the new twist that I talked about in the column and that comes out in work by another great anthropologist, Michael Girvin, is that, all right, so are those older people just, you know, going out and digging for roots and making peanut butter sandwiches to feed those little hungry grandchildren? Well, there's something else that they seem to be doing. I mentioned that the thing that the children are doing is learning. So they're learning about the world around them, the environment around them. But one of the things that's really distinctive about people is that we have culture, right? So we're not just learning about the objects around us. We're learning the traditions of our particular group. We're learning we can accumulate all the things that everybody else before us learned. And what Girvin suggests is that when it comes to that kind of cultural learning and transmission, it's, again, really the older people, the grandmothers and grandparents, who are passing on to the younger people, to the children, the things that they need to know about how the world works, the stories, the myths, the information about other people, the things that are the ethical principles that are really important. What Girvin found was that the prime of life people, the people in their 30s and 40s, were so busy doing all the things we do in our 30s and 40s, you know, going out and producing and finding our way in the pecking order and finding mates and all those things, that they don't really have a lot of time to do this activities of things like telling stories. And it's really the grandparents who have a lot more knowledge but aren't as productive. That kind of combination means that they're the perfect people to be teachers. They're the perfect people
I love
to
it.
Be spending their time with the grandchildren. And I have to say, autobiographically, as a grandmother, I don't know if you're in that fantastic phase of life yet, but that is something that grandparents do a lot, and I think something we learn from our grandparents, too.
I think it's incredibly valuable, and the answer is yes, I am. And so I completely, I'm totally there with you. In the column, you know, bringing this sort of to the wonderful world of the pandemic, you say, from an evolutionary perspective, caring for vulnerable humans at either end of life lets all humans flourish. So to your point that you just described, the pandemic, however, has made us realize both the importance and the difficulty of this kind of care. In the richest society in history, the job of caring for the old and the young involves little money and less status. Elders are often isolated. Perhaps after the pandemic, we'll appreciate better the profound connection between brilliant, fragile young learners and wise, vulnerable old teachers, and bring the grandchildren and grandparents back together again. You know, that whole thing is so poignant about what's going on with older people today who have to, you know, it's ironic. We sit back and we say, okay, we're going to have a strategic reopening. And we have to protect the most vulnerable, but everyone else just go out there and wear your mask and, you know, get back to life. Well, what about our elders? What's going on with them? You know, they're all alone and they're really not getting the connections. And it worries me. How do you feel about that?
Well, you know, I think as lots of people have said, one of the effects of COVID has been to make the things that were already there and problematic in the society just much more vivid. So I think that it's been a scandal for a long time that so many people have to face institutions like assisted living facilities. And, you know, it's funny because it's one of those things that everybody feels is just their own individual problem. So think about all the people, you know, who are saying, I don't know what to do about my parents. You know, they live really far away. None of us are around to take care of them. They're getting more fragile. I can't went to the house and, you know, the house wasn't cleaned up, but should we put them in, you know, I also went to the assisted living facility that's nearby, and it's okay, but boy, it seems kind of depressing. I mean, all of us are kind of going through that, and I think it reflects the fact that we just don't have a good way of taking care of our elders, and I think if you compare us to most societies for most of time, you know, the assumption was that elders had a kind of special wisdom, and it was worth putting some time and energy into caring for them and taking care of them, and also integrating them into the society at large. So you're starting to see, and I think it's a kind of interesting change, you're starting to see, even before COVID, you were starting to see more multi-generational housing. There's some wonderful programs for putting together older people and little kids. So Mark Friedman, who's actually in Berkeley.
Yes, I know him very well.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. Mark Friedman has these wonderful, wonderful proposals for having an Abuela Corps. So, you know, when we have universal child care, have older people who are not necessarily the teachers, but who are just, you know, like the grandmother for that class. So you can have those close, intimate relationships across the generations. And I think there's lots of evidence and reason to think that would be really good both for the little kids and for the older people themselves. So the COVID has just made the fact that we don't take care of our younger children and we don't take care of older people really, really, and we don't bring them together in the way that they seem to have been designed to be brought together by evolution. That was all happening before COVID, but COVID has made it really, really vivid that that's true. And it's made it obvious how, you know, it really does take a village to raise a child, and it's been kind of interesting in COVID. For instance, I'm very jealous. I have two sisters who are also grandmothers, and my sister in D.C., her daughter and son and grandson just moved into the house with them, and I think you can see other examples of people of people doing that, and that is a way of getting that extra care that we wouldn't already have. So, you know, I think we were neglecting children and the problem of taking care of children and elders before COVID, but COVID is making us realize both how much we were neglecting them, how little backup we had, and also just how important they are. I think this is the thing more than anything else that hits people is this separation between children and older people. It's really hit people how important taking care of children is and how important taking care of elders is.
Yeah, you know, it's very interesting. As you speak, I'm thinking of my own grandmother. I was born and raised in San Francisco, and we live very near the beach over near Cliff House. And what she would do is take us little ones by the hand and take us down to the sand, and she would point and say, "That way is Mexico." And at the age of three, I would take my little sand pail and I would start marching toward Mexico, saying, "You know, I'll let you know when I get there, and it's all good." And my grandmother roll her eyes and go, "There we go again." And then she'd have to explain once again things about, you know, how big countries are. You can't just walk to Mexico. It doesn't work that way. And to this day, you know, a million years later, that is one of my fondest memories. And it would break my heart to think that children are being robbed of that in a big way. And to your point, there's a huge issue here, very big one. COVID has exposed a lot of the weaknesses and vulnerabilities of societies all around the globe. There's no question about it. In our society, it has really forced a conversation about how we value life. You know, how do we value life? And if we value life, why are we paying people $10 an hour to take care of these people? You know, why?
Well, this is, you know, something that lots of people have pointed out is, boy, now we know who the essential people really are, don't we? And the essential people are those people who are working to take care of elders, for example, which, again, both, I mean, you know, it's amazing, taking care of elders, taking care of children, preschool teachers on the one hand, people working in elder care on the other, are absolutely at the bottom of every possible economic and social pecking order. And it turns out they're really the essential people. They're the people we can't do without. That's the work that we can't do without.
Yeah, and that just blows your mind when you think about it. And it stripped us bare. It made us look at that. I mean, there was no fluff around this. There was just no playing around. Why do you think thousands died? Because the assisted care facilities, for instance, have just such poorly trained people. Whose fault is that? Where'd that come from? And if our elders are that valuable to us in our society, as we define it, then why are we treating them this way? It's huge. And then it strips down something else, too. How about that, you know, healthcare they are or are not getting? One of the reasons why they're so vulnerable has really not a lot to do with their age per se. It's the fact that they have comorbidities associated with their age, meaning that they have a multitude of conditions, they're on medications. There's no question that the aging process, no matter what kind of shape you're in, is going to have some kind of effect on immune function, but it's going to be so minimalized if you're really in great shape and you take good care of yourself and you do get top-level medical care. But are you getting top-level medical care? What's going on there? You know, here we go, another layer gets stripped off, and then we see it for what it is. That's why one of the reasons why I was so captured by your column in the Wall Street Journal, which I highly recommend everyone read, and it is called Why Elders Are Indispensable for All of Us. I just thought it was, of course, beautifully written because you wrote it, and aren't I just full of it today? But no, seriously, it was just written beautifully. It was from June 12th in the Wall Street Journal. It was like a big slap in the head with a 2x4 about, wait a minute, what are we doing with elders in our society? You know, I've had the pleasure of meeting some of the blue zoners, you know, the centenarians plus. I was in Nicoya once, for instance, in Costa Rica, and I met probably one of the more famous ones from the original Blue Zone book. Her name was Panchita. Cochila. And at the time I saw her, she was 109 years old. And absolutely amazing. Seven generations of her family alive at one time. It's breathtaking. And just to watch the way that they're taken care of, they would no sooner put someone in, and I quote, a home, than jump on the moon. It was a granddaughter. Remember, you have to do some math here because there's so many generations here. But it's a granddaughter who's actually taking care of her. And the granddaughter is just absolutely honored to do so. And they're treated and they're revered. It's just breathtaking how they talk about one another and how they connect and how they bond. And then I come back home and it's like, not so much. You know, it's kind of, there's a variability there that blows your mind. And so, you know, the other thing that's also happening here is not just assisted care, but it also prompts us to talk about what you said and with your sister here in Washington, D.C., and that is you have multiple generations, you know, living in one house, and suddenly you're having conversations and connections and bonds that maybe you didn't fully appreciate before. I think that that's a positive. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, and I think, again, even before COVID, the real estate people were saying that was the biggest trend that they were seeing was people wanting to have people really differently from, say, my generation, where people kind of like couldn't wait to get away from the extended family. Now people are wanting to sort of reconstruct those extended families and recognizing the value of them. Now, you know, part of the problem is that if you think about it, none of the care work that anybody does shows up in the GDP, for example. So for many, many years, and of course it's been women who've been doing this, you know, a really deep essential part of who we are is the way that we care for each other, the way we take care of someone who's sick, the way we take care of children, the way we take care of elders. And because that's always been done personally, which is the way to do it, right? It's because it's me taking care of my child or you taking care of an elder, that work has been sort of invisible. It hasn't, as I say, it doesn't show up anywhere in the GDP. So that, you know, that sister who's the one who's looking after the father, or for that matter, we realize now the people who are looking after all children, that's actually not just important, but as important as anything we do, and it's invisible. We don't have any way of acknowledging it. We still, you know, treat people who are staying at home and taking care of kids as if they're kind of second-class citizens. One good thing that may come out of COVID, I've seen an awful lot of tweets from guys saying, oh, I finally realize how important teachers are. I'll never say anything bad about a teacher again.
Oh my God, we're not going to do any more homeschooling. Help me. Oh my gosh. Well, you know, you brought up, you know, as we wind this up, you brought up an amazing point, and that is, you know, what can we really now expect? Is this just going to be a flash in the pan, you know, this whole issue with what we're seeing now and what has been revealed by COVID? Or will there be stickiness to this? And if there is stickiness, what should we do with that? How can we make this sustainable?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a really good question. It's funny, I just tweeted something where I was listening to the Ezra Klein show, and he was talking to Ezekiel Emanuel, who's, you know, a well-known public health expert.
Sure.
A couple of weeks ago, he had been talking to Raj Chetty, who's a famous economist. And he'd just independently just asked each of them, like, what's the biggest thing we could do to improve health? And what's the biggest thing we could do to reduce inequality? And they both had exactly the same answer, which is invest more in early childhood. That's the thing that really empirically just, you know, and this is not coming from developmental psychologists or touchy-feely women. This is coming from pretty hard-nosed public health and economics people saying, no, if we want to improve those things, the biggest thing that we can do is take better care of our young children. And I think a really lovely idea is that taking care of our elders and taking care of our young children go together. That's the idea that comes from the evolutionary biology. Those two things go hand in hand. If we were taking better care of our young children and taking better care of our elders and putting those two groups of people together, so that part of taking care of elders would be, you know, that you would get paid for being the grandparent in the childcare, and that would make it easier to do childcare because we would have more people involved in childcare, and vice versa, being able to have that role. You know, four-year-olds adore grandparents. Like the grandparents, this is a good thing about being a grandparent, is like you really get a lot of love and respect.
I know, they love you.
Your own children, right? You're the favorite. One of the evolutionary points, of course, is that, you know, if you think about before we had written language, you could get 150 years of human history through a grandparent talking about their grandparents. So my beautiful little blonde granddaughter's absolutely favorite thing to do is to get my husband to tell stories about his grandmother, and he's 75. So his grandmother was around in the 19th century ranching in New Mexico and had all sorts of adventures, was, you know, building her own house and pulling the heads off chickens. And there's nothing that the granddaughter likes better than hearing preferably the more gory stories about what Grandma Pearl, could do. So that's a really special relationship. One of the things I say sometimes is I think from the evolutionary perspective, there's a good argument that we're basically human up till puberty and after menopause. That's when we're doing the most distinctively human things. In between, we're basically kind of glorified primates. We're going out doing the things that all the other primates do, mating and doing well in the pecking order and trying to get resources. But, you know, the things that are really human, teaching and learning and culture and tradition, and those are the things that we do when we're really young and when we're really old. Now, we do some of it in between as well. I don't want to be too hard on my middle-aged, on my younger colleagues. But I do think those things are really valuable and distinctive. And hopefully what we could do is just change. And, you know, another thing to say is the United States, exceptional as in so many other respects, in that we don't have universal child care. We don't have parental leave. We don't have support for elders. So those, it's not like there's some, you know, mystery about how a place like North Scandinavia or even France or Italy do those things. In fact, one of the things that's really, East Asia, for example, where older people are treated with much more respect and care. In fact, one of the things that was terribly sad about Italy, for example, is that that older people and younger people were together that made the older people so vulnerable. That's been true in places like the Hasidic communities in New York as well. But those are the things that we really want to preserve on the other side of this. And as I say, it's not rocket science to figure out how to do that. And it's something that lots of other civilized countries have done much better than the United States has in the past. But there's no reason why we couldn't do it too.
Well, you know something, I could listen to you for maybe, I don't know, forever, and we could talk about this. You're so damn smart about this, and once again, I'm just so honored to have you on the Her podcast. I'm going to threaten you now with repeat performances, because seriously, the issues you deal with are that relevant, and we have a large listening audience that's probably been taking notes right and left and falling off their chairs right and left as they listen to you really reframe the narrative in a big way. So I want everyone out there in the Her Podcast land to run on over to something that I saw a while ago, and this is Dr. Allison Gopnik's famous TED Talk, which has now been viewed by more than 4 million people, and it is called What Do Babies Think? It is absolutely amazing. So what do babies think? Instead of, you know, doing that damn Netflix, put that thing down. I want you to just do something good for your brain and watch a phenomenal TED Talk by Dr. Allison Gopnik. And again, we have been talking to Dr. Gopnik about her Wall Street Journal column, Mind and Matter column, that was recent. It was called Why Elders Are Indispensable for All of Us, and she has basically made the case so beautifully that we now need to understand the jewels that we have in elders and how we have to begin to reframe this whole definition of what is important to us in our own culture. Our young ones, our more vulnerable older ones, actually both ends of the spectrum are quite vulnerable, and the beautiful synergy, and then everyone else in between. I don't know, just do something out there, mate, go find somebody, go work, forage, do something. But those two ends of the age spectrum are absolutely sacrosanct. Dr. Gopnik, thank you so much for being on the HER podcast.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
And go Bears. Sorry, everybody. It's a Berkeley thing. I can't help myself. Okay, now everyone out there, you were absolutely transfixed, weren't you? Raise your hand. See, I knew it. All right, so run on over to iTunes right now and rate and review this amazing show. Listen to it a million more times because, again, I can listen to Dr. Gopnik all day long. Why? Because I'm Dr. Pam Peek and I host the HER podcast. Follow me on Facebook at Dr. Pam Peek or Twitter at Pam Peek MD. And remember to catch every single episode of the HER podcast on iTunes or Radio MD. Thanks for listening today and stay safe and stay well.